Your host today is Mike Riley. Mr. Riley, take it away.
Thank you very much, Katie, and welcome again, everyone, to our fourth Robert Ringer Mastermind Discussion Group conference call. Our guest today is Mr. Bob Bly, who Robert will introduce to you in a few moments. Now let's get on with business by turning the microphone over to the people's philosopher, Robert Ringer.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm really excited about this call because I know a lot of our members own businesses. They're all entrepreneurs, certainly. And so everybody's in business. Everybody that's an entrepreneur knows that marketing is one of the real keys, probably the most important thing that you can do in a business. And we have with us today someone that I've known for a couple of years now, and I'm very familiar with his work. I've heard him speak. And, boy, if you need a guy to do marketing consulting, to write ad copy for you, to help you in any way, or if you have businesses to come in and speak, this is the guy you want because he's really, really top-notch. Bob, welcome to the Mastermind Discussion Group.
Well, thanks, Robert, and thanks for having me.
Okay, because we have the usual short fuse, and I know what Bob has to say. He could probably fill 8 hours real easy, but let's kind of take it from the top, Bob, and just tell everyone, because you've got an illustrious career and everybody in the business knows you and knows of your accomplishments. How did you get started in the copyright and marketing business?
Well, in copywriting and marketing, the short version is that I majored in college in chemical engineering, but my real interest was writing. And when companies came on campus to interview senior chemical engineering majors to hire them, the recruiters saw that I was interested in writing. And a couple of the corporate recruiters said, you know, we need writers at our companies. And they didn't use the term copywriter, although that's what it was. We need writers to write marketing materials, and having a technical background would help. So I got a couple of job offers, and I started out as my title was marketing communications writer at Westinghouse, and went on from there.
You know, it's very interesting as you say that. We could do a whole hour just on this, but how so many of us start out in one direction, and you really don't know what the future holds. That's why I always say the future is very exciting. Your story reminds me very much of John Stossel's story. He started out, went to Princeton, and he wanted to go into hospital management and had got accepted to the Chicago School of Hospital Management. And he decided to take some time off, and he just literally stumbled into a job working for a TV station out in Seattle. And one thing led to another, and he ended up being a big television personality. So that's a little side tip that all of you should remember, that you don't really know what the future holds, so you have to keep your eyes and ears open for opportunities. And the same thing has happened to me in many respects also. I had no idea that I was going to end up being a writer. Now, you call yourself a direct response copywriter, and I want to get real basic here. What exactly is meant by the term direct response copywriter to make sure that we're all on the same page?
To simplify it, direct response copywriting is writing ads, direct mail packages, other marketing materials that are designed to elicit a direct response, typically either generate an inquiry, the customer wants more information about your product, wants a copy of your catalog, or to generate a sale. Customer sends you a credit card number or a check for $100 and buys your product without seeing you in person. This contrasts with what we call general copywriting, general advertising, which is usually to create awareness of a product, the kind that's practiced on Madison Avenue, and is not sell the product directly. There's no direct action, or if there is, it's not focused on that.
You know, I'd be interested to know if you agree with me on this. I know the great Joe Carbo, who wrote The Lazy Man's Way to Riches and ran the series of famous ads back in the 70s, I got to know him, and he absolutely felt that billions of dollars literally are wasted on quote-unquote Madison Avenue ads. It's interesting how Super Bowl time, nobody talks about selling the products. They just give awards for the best ads. So I'm very anti-Madison Avenue. I suppose sometime it works. But there's a book that you probably read, Bob. I'm trying to think of the author. But I think it's called The Rise of PR, The Downfall of Advertising and the Rise of PR. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, I think it's I think it's written by Trout and Reese.
No, it's not that. It's a guy and his daughter.
Oh.
I have it over there on a bookshelf somewhere. But it's a must read because and he quotes David Ogilvy in there, who basically said that Madison Avenue mainstream advertising firms are just a bunch of show-offs, and they literally are in it for the awards. And Carbo used to say if any of these guys actually had to produce direct results, as Bob was just talking about, they'd probably be out of business. But you show me a guy who's a direct marketing copywriter, if he's in business for a long time, it means he actually writes copy that gets people to send in their money. And I think you'd agree, Bob, when you're starting out, that's not an easy task to get somebody to open their wallet or take out their credit card, is it?
No, especially if you've not been trained in it, and people who grow up or trained on Madison Avenue specifically learn not to do that. Other things are valued there. What's valued in Madison Avenue is being very pithy and concise, being clever, and being creative. And, you know, what's valued in direct response is very simple. Did my ad make money?
Yeah, exactly. And that was another thing that Ogilvy, Claude Hopkins, Carbo, they all taught is to try not to be clever in ads. I know the temptation is great, and I've made the mistake many times, especially when starting out. But as David Ogilvy said, spending money is a serious matter to people. And if people think that you're just trying to be funny, you know, they may laugh. They may say it's a great advertisement. But I have firsthand experience. I can tell you they won't buy the product. All right, let's go on to business to business. Now, we talked about direct response copywriting. What is the term business to business marketing mean?
Well, if I'm a business, I might sell to one of two different markets. I could sell directly to the consumer. Pepsi Cola does that, for example. Burger King does that. Or I could sell to another business. If I make, let's say, photocopiers, I would sell it to libraries, and then consumers would come in and use the copier, but the big copier was purchased by the library. So business to business is a company that sells their product or service to an institution, business, or other organization versus an individual consumer.
So that would be, am I right, that would be a category under direct response?
Yeah, direct response, business to business, like consumer advertising, can be either direct response or general. And I actually wrote a book on this topic, which is still in print, called Business to Business Direct Marketing, where I make the claim that for business to business, direct marketing is many times more effective than general advertising, which should be largely avoided.
And what do you think, in your experience, I haven't had a lot of experience, almost no experience in that area, Bob, what do you think the mindset or the mentality is of selling to a business person or the person you're trying to sell to from the copywriter standpoint as opposed to selling to a consumer?
Well, there are more similarities than there are differences, but there are 7 key differences, and I've written on that. If people go to my website, they'll find articles on that that they can read for free. But there are differences, and if you ignore them, you're going to be ineffective. One of the big differences, for example, is that a consumer, if I go to Burger King and I want a hamburger and I'm an adult, I can buy that hamburger. But if I'm advertising a business system or product to an adult manager at a company, he may actually only have the authority to spend $1,000. If my product is $6,000, he has to get someone else's approval. So a lot of the business buying is done in committee, not by individuals. That's one key difference.
So what do you do about that? If you're sending it out to somebody, the guy who reads it doesn't have the authority, how does that change your copywriting?
Well, you make your copy appeal to the interests of each segment, and you often, if it's direct mail, will mail to one more than one person at the company. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I did a very successful direct mail campaign selling disaster recovery technology and services for a major telco, and their market was, you know, the Fortune 2000. And we basically sent a personal letter about this disaster recovery and why it was so important to the CFO and the CEO, the top executives, and said at the end, P.S., you really want to take this letter over to your IT manager and discuss this before there's a big problem. Then we sent a letter about the service to the IT manager at the same company, and we said, P.S., we mailed this same information to your CEO. He's going to be asking you about it. You ought to go over and talk to him about it. And it did very well.
So there's a way to get through. Okay, great. I'm going to throw a really broad one, and I don't expect you to cover it in just a matter of a few minutes, cover the whole subject, but just so everybody can get their feet wet, could you, as an expert, kind of cover some of what you think off the top of your head are the more important aspects of good copywriter, of a good copywriter?
Of a good copywriter, or of good copy?
I'm sorry, I misspoke myself. Aspects of good copywriting. What are when you sit down, what are you looking to do?
This is, again, a subject which you and I could speak about for many hours, if not days, but if we were to boil it down to a few things. Number one, and it's the number one mistake people make, they start with the product, which is what they do on Madison Avenue. So more important than the product is the prospect. People are interested in themselves. They're concerned about their worries, their problems, their fears. If you start your copy with the prospect's feelings and emotions, then link that to your product and how it can help with those, you'll be much more successful. So you have to really understand the prospect and their emotions and what's going on at a deep level. Concurrent with that, we use the word emotions. People make, it's an old saw, it's an old saying, but it's true. People make buying decisions largely based on emotion and then use logic to justify them before signing the check. And you have to be able to reach them on an emotional level. And to do that, you have to know what are their feelings now. In other words, if you're selling an investment, are they greedy? Are they scared? Are they nervous? Are they interested in making lots of money or protecting what they have? You have to know what they're feeling and tie in with that. And if I had to pick a third thing, I'd say you want to, and this is very basic copywriting 101, you want to convince the prospect that your product is different or better than your competitors. In other words, if there's no difference, you're a dry cleaner and there's five other dry cleaners in your town and there's no difference, then you can't convince someone to pick you instead of the other four people. So you have to come up with what's known in marketing, and you know this well, as the USP or unique selling proposition, the thing that makes your product different and better than the competition.
You know, you hear that for years, but when you think about it, it's just common sense, because you're, especially in this day and age, and it was different when I was a young man, but in this day and age, you're just getting hammered from every direction on the internet, on TV and radio, billboards and so forth. You're getting hammered with people wanting to sell you things, so when you stop and think about it, it really makes sense. You have to have a reason that the person should shell out his money and buy your product rather than somebody else's, so I would underscore that. You'd be surprised, probably. Well, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, Bob, how many people who've never done marketing before have never heard of USP or unique selling proposition.
Right, and those that inherently know that they should make they should give a benefit of their product don't know how to construct a unique selling proposition. The worst one, and you hear it all the time. You ask someone, well, why should I go to your restaurant or why should I go to your dry cleaner? We're better. Better is the worst USP in the world, because it's general, and because you're saying it, no one believes you.
Yeah, I believe that.
Bob, this is Mike.
Yep.
speaking with what Robert just said there, we're just hammered with ads from all over the place. It just brings to mind the headline. I guess how important is the headline is kind of foolish to ask, but I guess, you know, what makes that headline one that you should use? I mean, I'm sure there's some components that might go in there that are that we could all just kind of remember, rules of thumb or something like that.
I don't think there's just one way to do headlines. I'm sure Robert would agree with this, but there are multiple headline techniques. One that Clayton Makepeace, who's a very well-known copywriter, uses all the time, and that I've adapted recently, and I think is good, is he says a good way to make an effective headline is to start with what he calls the conversation in the prospect's head. In other words, if you're selling detergent, your prospect thinks my underwear always comes out colored when I do laundry. You know, you have a headline. You know, now you run. You know, your underwear can be, your whites can be white. There was a James Webb Young, who was a famous copywriter in the early 20th century, said that one day he was sitting around and he had the thought. He was a middle-aged man at the time and had had kids late, and he said, why does every father hope that their first child will be a boy? And he wrote it down. He said, and then he found a product where he could apply it. He said, because it was such a good headline, because it was universal. People think that. So
yeah.
Start with what they're thinking.
Well, you know, I see these headlines that I think are just very powerful, and one that just comes to mind is, well, I guess it's a headline. and it's one that advertises a product, and they use the term belly fat, which is kind of like a real down and dirty kind of a way of saying lose weight. You know, get rid of that ugly belly fat. And it seems like it's like a key phrase of some sort.
I think what makes that work, what makes that work is it's specific. Specifics are always better. It's better to say belly fat than just fat. You know, if you're telling a joke and you say, "Wow, she spits like a baseball player." If you use the descriptor, "She spits like a major league baseball player," that's funnier. So the specifics help sell it, and also you're using a term when you say belly fat that the reader can visualize. Like I actually wrote a weight loss ad that ran in the Daily News and was very successful for a client, and it had a subhead that said just like that: "Get rid of your pot belly, turkey neck, chicken wing arms, thunder thighs, big butt," and we listed everything. And people who read it, they crack up, and the ad did very well because people would look at that list and say, "I have that," and it was said in such a way that you felt like you don't want to have that.
Oh, man, that's great.
You know, and that, not to get off on a tangent here, but you said people buy on emotion, and there's been a lot of discussion about negative headlines, and one of the most, and I'm going to get into the weigh in on the headlines a bit because I've had a lot of experience with headlines, some spectacularly successful experience, and just as many really bad experiences with headlines. And probably the most successful ad I ever ran was for a book that I published called Crisis Investing. And they said that the people who saw the ad said it wasn't going to work, and the title of the ad was Why You Will Probably Lose Everything in the Coming Depression. And interestingly, it just blew a hole through the ceiling. The book went from totally unknown to number one on the New York Times list within 3 weeks and stayed there for 15 weeks. Of course, as Bob will tell you, you get humble. You learn to get humble in this business because about the time you think you know why something works, it doesn't the next time. But all I could figure was that it was at a time that the economy was very shaky, and I think people were really concerned about their investments and everything, and so that was emotion in a big way, in a negative way, because that's one of the things that I think prompts people to buy, is if they think they're nervous about something, and there's an ad that tells them that they can maybe save themselves. Now, another part of that, Bob, is, as you know, if you run an ad on how to prevent cancer, normally people don't get into prevention. It's hard to get people to part with their money for prevention. But I've always said that if you've got cancer and somebody runs a headline that says guaranteed to get rid of your cancer in 10 days or your money back, you're probably going to buy the product. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's another classic observation, that it's much easier to sell cures than to sell prevention, unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's see. Abridged version of story through. What I try to do is tell an abridged version of the story through the headlines, the subheadings, the bold and the bordered copy, because a lot of times, Mike, you've said this many times, you don't really read ads all the way through, right?
No, I just
so I think it's really it's really important for the headlines and the headings to be placed in a way that people can sort of see the whole story as they glance down the page. Do you try to do that at all, Bob?
Yeah, and in a large mailing piece, let's say a self-mailer that's many pages, a magalog or a tabloid or a digest, I'll actually also put a lot of the selling information in sidebars because people also don't read linearly. So, you know, we'll have a separate sidebar. Let's say it's a health product, and we'll have a separate sidebar on one of the ingredients in a study that was done on it, and then maybe we'll tell them to go to the order form to get a premium, a special report on that study.
And another thing that's great to do in a headline, and I think the masters of this are the infomercial makers, is try to write a headline. Actually, try to write all the copy this way, but especially in the headline, the all-inclusive strategy. And they say that the best headline you could ever write would be, if your name's Mr. John Jones, the headline would say, "Hey, John Jones, this ad is for you." And you try to write it in such a way so that elderly people are going to be interested, young people, African-Americans, whites, and so forth. Do you normally try to use some hook like that in your ads?
I would say yes and no. I do try to let the reader see himself or herself in the ad. But at the same time, you know, I do use for certain product categories and certain offers, I do use an ad that selects the reader. I mean, a simple basic example of this is if you're selling this is actually an ad that ran. I didn't write it. It was from an insurance company. It says, important life insurance news for men and women over 50. If this is an insurance company, they sell life insurance to everyone, but they had a special policy that the rates were really good if you got a small policy over 50. So that headline then, if you're over 50 and you're worried about life insurance, that will work for you.
Yeah, that's the flip side of the coin.
And
I guess it depends who's reading the ad copy, and if it's direct mail, what list is it going to, and so forth. One other thing I might mention, and you've heard me talk about this before, Bob, and it's worked really well for me in a number of occasions, is what I call the perception preceding reality strategy, where, particularly in your headline, but throughout the ad, you try to create a perception that this product you're talking about, when I first did this was on my first book, with a headline that said, what's all the commotion about? And the idea was to make the person reading the ad feel like, wow, there's something big happening, and I'm going to be left out if I don't get on board. And then eventually, if the ads are successful, the perception, the reality catches up with the perception. So I'm a big believer in very exciting, very bold headlines. Where obviously you don't want to make outrageous claims, but don't be afraid to really be bold in your.
Yeah, that particular technique I think you possibly invented, and I've seen others use it. For example, Agora had a promotion for a financial newsletter that did so well it mailed in the many millions of copies, and the headline of it was the first great economic event of the 21st century. It sounds so important,
yeah.
And you want to know what it is. Had they said what it was on the cover, the promotion would have been reduced to the ordinary.
Yeah, that's an absolutely great great headline. And I used in those ads going back to the 70s, near the bottom, I had things like, right under the headline, I had on the verge of becoming the most talked about business book in history. And it was always laughed about that because that was my view, that it was on the verge. I didn't say it was the most talked about business book in history, and it's not something that you can prove anyway. But, you know, when people read that, they think, wow, on the verge of becoming the most talked about business. And I did at the bottom, and I used to run ads with B. Dalton and Bertano's in New York and Walden Books, and I got B. Dalton to put under their name skyrocketing toward the top of our bestseller list. At the time, it wasn't at the top of the bestseller list, but it was skyrocketing toward. Well, as a result, the reality caught up with the perception, and it ended up being at the top of their bestseller list for a long, long time. All right, let's move on because we do have a lot more to cover here. Talked about the subheadings. How about studying? Because I know that you're big on this, Bob. How about if a person's going to become a copywriter, knowing what they have to do when it comes to studying the product before they really even start writing the ad?
Well, I'm fond of saying that the best thing about being a copywriter is that you'll always be learning things. And the worst thing about being a copywriter is that you'll always be learning things. There's a guy around the corner who's got a shoe repair. He's a craftsman. He repairs leather shoes. And I think he learned everything he knew 40 years ago, and it hasn't changed. But here, you know, we constantly have to learn new stuff. And one of the things you have to learn is the product. And, of course, it depends. Is it an information product? The preparation or the way to get ready to write the copy would be different for each. But basically, you're going to read, use, eat, or take the product, and you're going to try it out. And then you're going to talk to people who already are users or readers of the product. And then you're going to talk to the people who are the creators of the product, the engineer who designed the system, the editor who writes the financial newsletter.
Okay, so there's no easy way out. It's like everything in life.
There's no easy way out. The only easy way out is if you tend to write copy for the same product category or narrow market niche, you gain familiarity over time. So maybe it's a new newsletter about exchange-traded funds. You've never worked for that newsletter, but this is the eighth promotion you've written on exchange-traded funds. You kind of know it already.
Right, but the point is you don't wing it. You got to know what you're. You got to know what the product.
Winging it is the worst you could do.
Right, and I'm sure like me, you're amazed at reading ads, it's obvious how many people do wing it. You know they're new because nobody who's experienced would write ads. Like some of the ads I see on the internet are just amazing. Now, let's move along to sales brochures, because I know you do a lot of work in sales brochures, and that's something some of our people might want to get into, or maybe they've got a business where they want to get into writing a sales brochure for their own business. How does that type of writing differ from writing ads?
Well, here's a good way to think about it. For whatever product you sell, you should map out, like in a flow diagram or with just a series of boxes with arrows pointing to them, going from top to bottom of the page or left to right, what's your sales cycle? Most of us don't sell a product in one step. Some of us do. So what's your sales cycle? A, B, C, D. Step A might be reader sees our ad and responds to it. Step B, we send the reader information. Step C, our telephone rep follows up in a week to qualify the lead and secure an appointment. Step D, one of our agents or representatives visits the prospect. And step E, we write a proposal and we close the deal or whatever. So you have to figure, where does your material fit in? The advertising usually comes in step A, generating the lead, while the brochure comes in step B, which is the prospect says, yeah, I saw your ad, send me something. Part of what you send them is the brochure, and its purpose is to give the prospect more information to help him make an intelligent decision about whether to buy the product or not.
Great. All right, before we get into internet marketing, and I know everybody's looking forward to that part of the discussion, there are two really important questions that I want to ask you because I'm in awe of anyone who writes as many books as you. First of all, how many books have you written to date, Bob?
I guess it's around, it's a little over 70.
Okay, well, I'll try
really?
To refrain from crying out loud on that one. I guess the $64 question, the obvious question is, how in the world do you find the time to turn out so many books? And I'm going to be listening intently to whatever you say, because I sure can't do it.
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, I do work very efficiently. For example, and you probably do too, but people will ask me about being a freelancer. Most freelancers work by themselves. I like to tell people, I haven't been to the post office in 17 years. I have assistants who do that. So I outsource every task that's not directly related to writing or thinking. And therefore, my day is freer to do productive work. That's one way that I do it. And the other one is that I just work longer hours. I like to work. I don't have that many other interests. I can't think of anything more fun than being involved with marketing and copy and books. Well, I can think of a few things, but nobody's asking me to do those. So therefore, I'm happiest when I'm sitting up here alone in my third floor office in this building in Dumont, New Jersey, when I'm happiest up here typing and it's quiet.
Wow.
And so I work 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then on the weekends I usually put in a few good hours, 3, 4, or 5 hours on one of the days, and the rest of the time there's not much. I spend time with my family.
It's kind of scary. I didn't know there was another me out there, but I can relate.
Oh, I knew you'd be the same because.
I love it. I love it. I call it my luxury dungeon, and I come down here every day. And I'll tell you, I'm just thrilled that computers were invented and that I learned to use one so efficiently, because it's amazing how much better it makes your writing. It makes it more fun. It makes it easier. And I'd be willing to bet you don't play golf, do you?
Do you? I do not play golf.
Ever. Now, I played twice when I was very young, and I ended up breaking the club.
I actually had a client who was a direct marketer, a great company. They direct marketing of computer leasing. And he told me, he said, Bob, my piece of advice to you is never learn to play golf, because he learned it to schmooze clients. And he says, and now it takes the whole day.
Yep, it's amazing. The only thing worse than golf is probably television. And if somebody starts talking to me about television, and I can tell they watch a lot, then I'm usually talking to somebody who's not getting anywhere in life, because television is a real poison, and people really underplay. Would you rather be listening to the latest saga of Donald Trump and Rosie, or making
money? There's the two arguments. One, that the content itself is very banal for the most part, and it's true, as you point out, you know, Donald and Rosie is typical, Sanjaya and all this. But the other one is that, you know, there's studies that say the act of watching TV, which is very passive, is bad, you know, is bad for your brain.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And the other question is, and I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating to people, because you've talked about it before, a lot of copywriters feel that it's not a good idea to write a book on copywriting. You write a lot of books, but you've written one, but they feel that people won't pay for their services. So it's that old territorial, guard your secrets and all that mentality. But you have a different way of thinking about this, don't you, Bob?
Yeah, that opinion that they have is wrong. The opposite happens. You've seen this phrase in advertising, admittedly not very good advertising. We wrote the book on X. But there's better advertising you can write, but it works because people want to go to the service provider, whether it's a copywriter, a marketing consultant, a website designer, who's perceived as the guru or expert. And we're in a society where if someone writes a book, rightly or wrongly, and a lot of times it's wrongly, we say they're the expert.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found this out in my second book, Looking Out for Number One. I talk about this and I say, you know, I hate to tell you this, but before I became a best-selling author, I was saying the exact same things that I'm saying now, and I would have just loved it if you'd have come up to me on a street corner and wanted me to tell you about it, but nobody was interested. I'd have probably even taken you out to lunch if you wanted to listen. But when you get printed material between a cover, there's something magical about it. I call it the ultimate calling card. Don't you find that to be true, Bob?
Yeah, Jeffrey Lanth, I don't know if you knew him, a marketing consultant and then went into internet marketing, said everyone who is a professional and renders professional services should try to write a book. He said a book is a brochure that is never thrown away.
Absolutely. Everybody on this line, all of our members, if you haven't written a book yet, you should start, even if it takes you 2-3 years to do it. Use my peckaway theory. Peck away at it every day or several times a week, because in this day and age, it's not like the old days where if you wanted to get 100 books printed up, it'd still cost you $25,000. Today, as you're all aware, I'm sure, there's print on demand, and for, I think, about $6-$7, you can get a paperback, a trade-size paperback, printed up overnight, 24 hours, and they'll even ship it out for you. And you can get a hardcover printed up for about $10. Again, overnight, there's a company in Nashville, Tennessee, maybe the biggest in the country, I don't know, called Lightning Source, and they turn out 43,000 books orders a day, and the average order is 2 books. And I'll tell you who uses these is self-publishing people use print-on-demand printers, and the other big source, probably the biggest source, are, believe it or not, the mainstream publishers, because now they don't have to carry a lot of inventory. They can carry books in on their backlist, and if somebody wants a book and they don't have it in stock, they just tell the print-on-demand, they shoot them an email or go on the internet or go on the web. They usually have, I know Lightning Source has a site, and they just get it. They push a button, literally, and the thing is printed on laser printers. So we're living in an amazing age. If you haven't written a book, you really ought to think about doing it. All right, let's get on to the internet, Bob, because this is the part that I think people are really licking their chops on. I guess for starters, the obvious question is, how is copywriting different in a general sense from the internet? Because I've heard a lot of debate on this and about font size and length of copy, because it's different reading on a computer monitor than it is reading hard copy.
Yeah, there are some font size issues and font choices, and I've covered this in my e-newsletter, and if people go to my website, they can look at the archive of back issues, and I've covered this recently. But
that would be
Bly.com. And okay. You see there's a sign-up box with the newsletter, and there's an archive, and you can read that. But that's graphic design. When you say copywriting, you mean how to write the copy for the online.
Right. Or do people think different? Do you have to approach it differently online?
Yeah. I think they're much – here's what I say. I think writing online and writing offline are pretty much the same. They're much more similar than they are different. However, there are a few small differences, and – those small differences are important, and to ignore them is an error.
Okay. Why don't we get into it? I know that that's your current specialty, internet marketing, and probably the majority of people on the phone are very interested in that. And I know that a lot of people fear jumping into the internet marketing game because they think it's too complicated for them. I've talked to so many people who just are afraid of it. And why don't you weigh in on this whole idea of it being complicated?
Well, internet marketing can, like anything else, you can take it. You can approach something in a complicated way or simple. Look at any software program you have on your computer, Word. Word has 8 million features that you could spend a lifetime learning. Do you and I know them? You know 3 things, 5 things. We all only use 5% of the capability. For internet marketing, the way I help people get started is I say, yeah, there's dozens of things to know, and you could spend a lifetime learning it. But you can make money just knowing like 3 simple things, and I teach people what they are, and that's all you need to get started. And yeah, if you master the more complex stuff as you go along, you can expand your business. But you can make, with being very simplistic in your approach, you can make many thousands of dollars every week working only a few hours a week. And that sounds like a hype con game from an infomercial, but it's absolutely true.
No, it is absolutely true. And you know how I feel about action, Bob, and I'm a big believer in action in all aspects of life, but particularly on the Internet. I found I didn't start learning about the Internet till I just jumped in and did it. And I made a lot of mistakes and it cost me some money, but I'll tell you can recover very fast on the Internet because things cost a fraction of what they cost in, for example, in hard copy direct mail.
Well, that's the thing that's neat about it. In the old days, everyone wanted to get into mail order, but even to do it small, it was too much money, and they couldn't take the loss. Now you can do it with so much less money up front that it's everyone can afford to test this and try it.
I can remember doing a couple of mailings back in the early 80s, one that lost $200,000, one lost $300,000. Today, that same mailing, you not only might not lose that much money, but it might be a bomb, and you might make a couple of thousand dollars. So we're living in a whole different world. It's very, very exciting. Now, I know you said that you have said that there's 3 main aspects to internet to an internet marketing program, and I guess the logical place to start is with the product. So, what kind of products would you recommend that people sell online if they want to go into internet marketing?
Well, of the 3 basic things you need to make money online, the first is a product. And you have 3 choices of what you're going to sell. You can sell services, professional services, consulting, coaching. You can sell merchandise, or you can sell information products. Each has their pros and cons, but for someone who wants to have a small home-based business and not work really hard and not build a big organization, I tend to lean toward information products. Because if you sell merchandise, for example, I know a guy who sells, and he's very successful, and he built a big company. He sells online. He sells wedding favors. But he has like an X thousand square foot warehouse. He has 40 employees. That's too much like work for me. So I wouldn't want that. And services, the problem with selling services is once you make a sale, then you got to go to work. The idea is doing the internet marketing is to stop trading your time for money, to make money sort of while you sleep. I mean, I happened to leave my computer on during this call, and we got 3 orders so far since we started. So I'm not working, but I just made $150. Not a lot of money, but...
But you'll take it.
But I'll take it. And I work nothing to do that. I mean, that's the beauty of it. So when you sell products, merchandise, or information, you can do that. Services are labor-intensive, so I say stay away from that.
Oh, listen, living in the information age and having the Internet is an absolute blessing. We're all so lucky. It's unbelievable. Now, tell us about your first information product. What was the first one that you did? You told me that it took you just just over an hour to create.
Yeah, what happened is I've been meaning to do this, and I know from reading you that action is what is the most important thing, and I had not taken action. So one day I was reading your book, and friends were urging me. I said, Dosh darn it, I'm gonna do this. And I said, I looked at my list, and I said, one of the things people on my list are interested in freelance is in how to make money as a freelance writer. That's a subject I write about, and people would be interested. What could I give them? And I realized I had written a series of about a dozen columns for Writer's Digest magazines. On the topic of making 6 figures as a freelance writer. They had all been published, and I own the rights. I only sold Writer's Digest the first rights. So I just pulled all those articles out off the computer, emailed them to my graphic designer, and said, make an ebook out of them. And he came back with a 100-page e-book or a 50-page e-book, whatever it was. And we named it Write and Grow Rich, and that was my first product. So not only did it only take me an hour of my time to pull those articles and email them to someone, I didn't do the design myself. I outsourced that, and that's a big part of my philosophy. I only do the things that I'm good at and let hire other people who are better and whose time is cheaper than mine to do the rest. And I actually had been paid for that. I'd already been paid for the content of those e-books, those articles. I didn't sit and write original stuff. So I was already like $7,500 ahead when I started.
You know, I remember when a very wise and wealthy friend of mine back in the early 80s said, you know, if I were you, we were having dinner. He said, if I were you, I wouldn't even be fooling around with new projects. He says, because it seems to me that you haven't even begun to exploit what you already have. And I said, well, I made tons and tons of money, seven figures on these books and everything. He said, yeah, but you're not doing any marketing of them. Probably since he told me that, directly or indirectly, probably mostly indirectly, I've made more money than I originally made on just my books alone by recycling and redeploying those assets. You know, people are always looking to raise money, but any good marketer knows that the easiest way to raise money is just redeploying your own assets and having money come in the door. As Bob says, he's sitting there and $150 just came in while he's talking. So I would be willing to bet that everybody on this line has those assets. All of you may not see them from where you're sitting. Maybe you want to talk to somebody, a friend or somebody, and let somebody analyze it and tell you what they see as your assets, because, as Bob said, you can redeploy them. He had those articles sitting right there. Now, a lot of listeners are probably thinking, how do I produce an e-book or an information product if I'm not a writer? That's a big question. People say,
well,
I'm just not a writer.
Well, there's a couple of ways to do it. The easiest way if you are not a writer. Let's say I'm not a writer, and I'm not even a subject matter expert, but I want to sell something, and I'm interested. Maybe I want to sell health information online. So I can find an expert like you're doing with me, and say, hey, I'll interview you on the phone for an hour, and that'll give me a CD I can sell to my list. And hey, in return, I'll give you a copy of the CD, and you can do with it what you want. And some people just make products that are recordings of teleseminars or not, don't even have teleseminars. They just do it over a conference line like we're doing. It's digitally recorded, and that's your product. So you can make an audio product, and a lot of my products are audio products. They're not written. My partner and I, Fred Gleek, we sit in a room, and he interviews me or I interview him about topics that we sell to our list, and we create products that way. And it's very efficient. Now, if you are a subject matter expert, and I had a guy call me today and said, gee, you know, I have all this material, I have all this content because I'm a consultant, and I have reports I've written for my clients, and I have, you know, articles that my PR agency has written for me about my specialty, but I'm not a writer. You can hire a writer. I'm embarrassed to tell you how cheaply. You can hire a writer to take your content and edit it into a book, because there's tons of people out there who are writers and can write quite decently, but they don't know how to sell or market their content or themselves, and they're making peanuts. And I'll tell you where you can find them online, elance.com, ELANCE.com. You can go on there and bid out your project, and you'll be amazed at the good people you get who will work for fees that will shock you how low they are.
Well, and I can vouch for that, because I remember reading a little squib somewhere, it must have been about the early 80s, that said that the average income of a professional writer is $4,500 a year. You only hear about the guys at the top, but the average guy is starving. It's kind of like show business. You know, you're in
the same curve exists in Hollywood.
Yeah, you love it, and, you know, sooner or later, you know, you might be like the next Dustin Hoffman, who was sweeping the stages on Broadway, and he gets a call to do The Graduate for $5,000. Let's move along. You've told me, Bob, that you sell $100 albums, and you never spent more than a half day creating any of them, and that's painful to someone like me who takes a very long time to create a product. So why don't you give us some insight into how you do that?
Well, I create my audio products, as I mentioned, with my partner, Fred Gleek, who's another internet marketer, and it's his system. And what we do is this. We pick a topic that one of us is an expert in. Let's say it's getting a book published, and we did a program on that. So he said to me, make an outline or make a list of questions that I should ask you about this. I mean, what do people want to know about it, about that? So it would take you about a half hour. I just make an outline or a list of questions. Maybe it would take me an hour at the most. And I give it to him. We get together in a room. with a digital, high-quality digital recorder, and he turns it on, and we each have a microphone, and we talk about it. And what's neat about it is, let's say we talk for 3 hours. We now have three CDs, 1 hour each, in our program. The reason it only takes 3 hours is it's real time, and we don't edit it. His theory is that people like, in audio, something that sounds real and live. And it seems to be true. There are other marketers who do very slick audio programs, Nightingale Conan. It's all scripted. It has sound effects, and it's packaged very nicely. And he says his theory is you want to avoid that. You want to be different. You have more specialized information, and people will pay you more for it if it doesn't look like a retail product. So we don't do any editing. And, you know, you hear funny things sometimes. Once we recorded one in the lobby of a hotel at a conference where we were both speaking, and, you know, a family walked by and the kids were talking to us, and we left that on the program, and people liked it.
Wow, I'll tell you, you just taught me something, because I'm sure Mike's sitting there thinking about this. Mike dug up a simple program for editing. And he edits right there on his own computer. Mike, why don't you tell him about that? Because now you've got to be thinking about this too. Bob is saying that you're better off to just sound like it's an everyday conversation.
I don't want to say that Mike is wrong. But this is what we found. This is one approach that has worked for us. Listen, Nightingale Conan's very successful, much more so than us, and they're highly edited.
Yeah, but it's a totally different approach. Go ahead, Mike.
If anybody's interested out there, the website or the program that I found, it's a free audio editor, and you can find it at http://audacity, A-U-D-A-C-I-T-Y, .sourceforge, S-O-U-R-C-E-F-O-R-G-E, .net, sourceforge.net. It's not a www. It's http://, without the www. And you can learn how to use it, and you can do your editing. So
maybe a great product. That's a terrible domain name.
It's awful, terrible domain name.
I'll tell you what impressed me, because I told Mike you know, that we had to go to a studio to do some things, and you can spend a couple of $1,000s in a studio. And he had trouble convincing me that he could do it right there in his own room. So it is amazing. But we got to think a lot about what Bob said, Mike, because that's quite fascinating, because we know other cases. I'm sure you're thinking of one that I'm thinking of, where a guy just sits in his living room and somebody talks to him and he tells him this is going to be just a casual conversation. So I get the drift. You're taking a simple approach, and that's simplicity is usually the best way to go.
What's funny is that, let me just mention, while you were talking, I came up with a better domain name, Edit Your Audio.
Yep.
I searched it. Someone has it. I then typed in Edit Your Audios, plural. It's available.
Really?
No kidding.
Yep.
Okay, well, Mike can go in business.
No, thank you.
Obviously, we have to move along, so we got some important points you have to cover. Part and parcel of this is the building of your own list, and I think everyone, including me, wants to know the great secret to building a big list. We're constantly working on it, and I'll be fascinated to hear your take on this ever-recurring question, Bob. How do you go about building your own list?
Well, the answer is there's no one technique, but there are some basics. First of all, there's two parts to building a list. One is to have a presence on the web, a page. A lot of people call it a squeeze page. Some people call it a sign-up or subscription page, where people can go and give you their email address to get on your list in exchange for you giving them something. And the best technique to use there is what we call a free-on-free squeeze page. And I can give you a URL for one of those if you like. And it's basically, for example, I publish a monthly e-newsletter, and yours is more frequent, I believe. It seems that I get it more. And so you publish a newsletter, but you don't just offer the newsletter, because there's so many newsletters, that's not enough. You say to the reader, if you will try my free e-newsletter, I will give you a bonus gift, and you give them a premium. So in the case of me, I have a squeeze page at www.bly.com/reports, and you can take a look at it just to see how it's done. And we took four of my reports that we sell on my website for $29 each, and if you sign up for my e-newsletter, you get them. So I can have a headline on my squeeze page that says, sign up for my now and get a marketing library worth over $100. So that's the basic method.
This is your free-on-free offer?
This is my free-on-free offer.
Yeah, we do something similar. We call it the free-free offer. But, yeah,
same thing.
Very, very well. Okay, another term I'd like to discuss, because I think it's important for everybody to understand, is cross-promo. What do you mean by cross-promo?
Cross-promo means, I'll give you an example. There are other people out there who have e-lists, e-newsletters or just lists that have as subscribers people you'd also want to have as subscribers. Robert Ringer and I have a lot of duplication and similarity in the market we target. So a smart thing would be, for example, for me to go to Robert and say, hey, why don't you promote me to your list and I'll promote you to my list. And when Gary Bensavenga, for example, launched Advertising Bullets, his e-zine a year or so ago, he called me up and said, can you plug it in your e-newsletter? And I didn't do it for money. I didn't charge him, but I did it with the understanding he'd help me in some way. And he told me within 72 hours after I did it, he had 1,000 subscribers.
Yeah, we've done a lot of those. We've done it with you, and it in fact we just did one with somebody a week ago, Mike.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, we've got over 2,000 subscribers from it.
Over 2,000 on one cross promotion.
On just
like
one
that.
Cross.
I mean, I've never gotten that much. I did one with Early to Rise. Part of their list for part of mine, and even though it was part of their list, I got like 950.
Yeah, so it can really pay off. How about some other terms we got to go over real quick? Viral marketing.
Viral marketing is basically you create something really cool on the internet and encourage people to share it with their friends. There was a great example. Burger King did one. Did you ever see the site subservientchicken.com?
No.
Well, it sounds silly, and it is silly. There's a website, subservientchicken.com, where you go there, and there's a guy in a chicken suit, and you type in commands, and he does what you say. What does that have to do with Burger King? Well, at the time, their slogan was, chicken sandwich made your way. So it was supporting the brand message, and I don't know if it was successful or not, but that's an example of viral marketing. People were passing this around like crazy, and to look at it, you had to give your email address, I think, as I recall it, and so that's an example of viral marketing. There's a guy out there, I don't know if you've seen his website, Conscious One, who's the largest seller of self-help audio and video content online, Scott Martinow, and he has a site, wisdomflash.com, where you can see all his viral marketing videos. And he tells me that his viral marketing videos have been watched on the internet by different people 17 million times.
Really?
And he built a list out of that of 650,000 subscribers.
So he doesn't sell them, he gives them
the away. Viral video you give away. You go to there, you can watch it. They're little, you've seen these, you perhaps have seen these where you click on it and there's some peaceful classical music and then there's some wise text and there's some beautiful pictures, that kind of thing. And you can see these at wisdomflash.com.
I'm sorry, Bob. I still don't understand what you said he's doing. The actual videos that you go see, what's the content of that?
The content is a feel-good, entertaining two-minute video. It's not really hardcore information. For example, he's a self-help guy. So if you go one of his things, we'll talk about inner serenity, and there'll be some quotes from Mother Teresa or Gandhi or something, and it's just the kind of, you know, spirituality type stuff. He has one on Christianity that talks about Jesus. There's one that, for example, tells a story about you watch it and there's a beautiful sunset and it says he never held office. He never wrote a book. And, of course, it's about Jesus. And people love to watch these things. And they watch them and sign up for the additional videos and they pass them on to their friends.
So at the end, what does it do? Ask him to sign up for his
email? Different ones work different ways, but a lot of them make you give the email address to watch it. So they capture your name that way.
But how does he get the people to come?
And there's a thing on it that says, wouldn't you like, if you want to, it comes with a box underneath. It says, did you enjoy this? Why not pass it on to a friend? And there's a box where you can type in your friend's email address. You type it in and hit send.
I see. Okay, that sounds exciting. And just one more thing on the list here. How about co-reg? Don't want to miss that.
Co-reg or co-registration is, you ever go on a website where you request, you sign up for something free, and instead of the website disappearing, a window pops up and says, you might be interested in these other interesting offers. And there's six things from six different companies. Those companies pay to have those spaces on that window. It's called co-registration. You sign up for my free ebook or my free report, and then you can sign up for my advertisers. So you can pay to be one of those, to have one of those co-registration spots, and you can add names to your list. When people click on that button and say, yeah, I want Robert Ringer's newsletter, I want Bob Lye's newsletter, and you get subscribers that way. And it's a very effective way. We just did a co-registration test campaign, and we got 5,000 new names for 65 cents a name, which is a pretty good price.
And how do you find the quality of the names to be as far as buying after that?
Well, that's what you have to watch. You have to ideally you do a small test. You get 5,000, 10,000 names. Then you stop, and then you track the names separately for maybe 90 days or so. And it's too early for us to tell, but initially they look good.
Okay. And how does email come into this whole picture here?
Well, email is the third thing. You have products. You have a list. But how do you get people on the list to buy your products? You send them an email. Could be daily. Could be weekly. We can talk about frequency, but you send them an email that says, hey, you know, you're interested in transcendental meditation. We have this great new program called doing TM, during your lunch break or something like that. And, you know, a percentage of people who get that email will click on it. There'll be a link sending them to a website where they can learn more about the product. A certain percentage will click on it. We call that the click-through rate. And then of those who click on it and go to that website that describes the product, a certain percentage will read the copy and order. We call that the conversion rate.
And
what about a service that you would use to send out those emails? You say you get 5,000 new subscribers. Send that out through your regular.
No, you don't use your regular email inbox. There are a variety of services. There are some standalone services for email distribution, which again on the vendors page of my website bly.com you'll see them. We use an integrated program, One Shopping Cart, which gives you autoresponders, shopping carts, credit card processing, email distribution capability, ad tracking capability. The choice is you can buy an integrated system or you can buy the pieces and parts each, and we prefer an integrated system.
Now, Bob, so when you talk about sending this out, you're talking about a straight ad as opposed to an e-letter or an e-zine.
Well, the mechanism is the same. If you send an e-newsletter, it's no different than sending a solo email to the same list. The software doesn't care what the content is.
But the big question is, if it's just an ad, people are going to get annoyed a lot quicker than if you're sending them information like in an e-letter or an e-zine, right?
Well, you have to balance it. If people think you're pitching them all the time and doing it in a mercenary way just to make money, they are going to unsubscribe. However, if you're giving them let's say you're giving them a weekly email newsletter. Let's take one case, and they love your e-newsletter. If you then once a month send them an email that says, hey, I know you're interested in mutual funds because you get my weekly mutual fund e-newsletter. Here's a great new book and audio tape set by my friend Joe Schmo, and you send an email and say, check it out. They trust you. That's part. They don't view that as a selling necessarily. They view that as a recommendation. And if you do it in that way, if you write the copy in that way rather than as a hard sell pitch, it'll work. And a percentage of people who get that will order the product. Now, every time you email to your list, someone's going to say, enough is enough. Even if you send a great issue of your e-zine, someone will say, I don't need this anymore. If you send a sales message, more people will need it. So you have to watch what we call your opt-out rate, the percent of your subscribers who leave every time you do an email broadcast or distribution to your list. And my rule of thumb is the maximum opt-out rate should be 0.1%. If your opt-out rates are higher, you're either emailing them too much sales stuff or you're emailing them too often or both.
You're saying 1/10 of 1%?
1/10 of 1%. So if you have 50,000 subscribers, you should not have more than 50 opt-outs when you send your e-blast.
Are you talking about 50 with each blast that you do?
With each blast. The opt-out rate is per blast.
Okay, that's interesting information.
Yeah, 0.1%.
This has been just fantastic. I can't believe it. You're a walking knowledge machine. Unfortunately, we're out of time now, but if some of our members would like to have all this and more spelled out, how do they go about looking into your Internet Marketing Retirement Plan?
They can just go to www.theinternetmarketingretirementplan.com, and it's my complete approach is there.
Okay, and it'll be all the things we talked about.
Everything we talked about.
Great. Bob, thank you very much. You're absolutely fantastic, definitely one of the best in the business, and I was sure impressed by everything you had to say. I'm sure our members were. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.